Hello, my name is Olivia Harding, and I am the host of Folk Files, a podcast that explores the tangled history of folk songs. Every month, I choose a topic to dive into for about 20 to 30 minutes. The subject of each episode could be a song. In the case of Shady Grove, a lot of people believe that it is a later version of the English folk song Matty Groves, but it's not that simple. A general topic. The main theme that I saw while researching folk songs about birds from all over the world is that many of them include nonsense syllables meant to represent the bird songs. Or a question that I want to answer. There has never been any real question that Black people were central to the development of this musical style. So why do we still picture white men hauling on the rope when we think of sea shanties? Press play and join me on a journey through the origins of murder ballads, sea shanties, rebel songs, and other music that has withstood the test of time. Folk Files is so pleased to be the newest show to join the BGS Podcast Network. Find us at thebluegrasssituation.com or where you listen.
They say there's nothing new under the sun, and ain't that the truth? The Working Songwriter has been on the air now for over 10 years and 300 episodes. As you've probably noticed, only the latest 100 published episodes are available in your podcast app and on Spotify. So we're bringing back some of the gems from past years. Of course, if you want access to every single episode of the show at any time, you can become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website, joepugmusic.com, where you can access any episode of the show for streaming and for download. In the meantime, we're bringing back some classic episodes to the main feed. Is that a reason not to join The Vault? Of course not, because it means that our latest episodes will only get paywalled all the sooner. Is this a relatively convoluted system? Of course it is. But such are the trade-offs that the ever-changing media landscape leaves us to navigate. Thank you for being here. It's always an honor that you listen to the show, and I hope that you enjoy some of these classic episodes. Today's episode with Robert Finley was originally aired on March 5th, 2021. I hope that you enjoy the show. Our guest this week hails from Louisiana and spent a lifetime playing music, only to find commercial success in his golden years. Robert Finley was born in 1954, one of eight children. Finley helped his family, who were sharecroppers, pick cotton throughout his childhood during the Jim Crow era South. His father was a deeply religious man and banned playing any blues music in their household. Finley's early musical career was mainly singing gospel music in church and in a family gospel quartet. Later, he discovered popular music and became a fan of Elvis Presley, Jimi Hendrix, Chuck Berry, Ray Charles, James Brown, and Bobby Womack. After a stint in the military, he returned to civilian life and worked as a carpenter for many years. When his eyesight began to fail him, the power of prayer led him to a career in music, that began at a point in life when many professional musicians are considering retirement. He caught his break when he was discovered busking in Helena, Arkansas, and given a shot on the hit TV show America's Got Talent, where he reached the semifinals. The Black Keys frontman, Dan Auerbach, became a fan around that time, and not only produced a pair of albums for Finley, but also released them on his label, Easy Eye Sound. Since then, Robert Finley has toured in 10 countries and appeared on PBS's NewsHour. The New York Times says that he is playing retro soul and blues that sounds fresh thanks to the only thing truly old-fashioned about Mr. Finley, his commitment to putting on a great show. NPR's World Cafe says that Finley's story is a quintessential American one of perseverance. And Rolling Stone poignantly noted of his star-crossed path, he lost his wife, his house, and his vision before becoming an undisputed star. Mr. Finley and I caught up on the phone earlier this week, and I was able to hear about his journey so far. Mr. Robert Finley, thanks so much for being on the Working Songwriter podcast. From what I've read, your childhood looked a bit different than the childhoods of many kids born now in the 21st century and in 2021. Seems like your childhood had a bit more work than it did play. Can you kind of describe to our listeners how you grew up?
Well, I grew up, as the album cover says, you know, the sharecropper's son. I had seven siblings, four boys and three girls, which I'm the youngest of the sons, and have one daughter that's younger, I mean, one sister that's younger than me. So I kind of got the last end of it, but it was a whole lot harder on them than it was on me, and simply because I just wasn't old enough to really to pull my weight in the field. But just being the water boy, making sure everybody had lunch on time, those were things that you would, if you could walk, you wasn't too young to do, you know. And we, you know, my part was basically pumping water and making sure that the horses and cows had water, and the mules when they came in from the field. And, you know, we did things like helping mom with chores. We had the old ring type washer. And actually, we thought we were playing. We didn't realize that it was actually work. But to be able to put the clothes through the ring up, and I, you know, had my share of the rub board. And it was, like the song say, it was hard, but it was fair, I guess. Everybody, whatever you was big enough to do, that's what you did. But school was not an option. We didn't have time for that. We got to go to school maybe 3 months out of a year. And that was the only time that there wasn't anything going on in the field. So it was really, you pick it, you know, you're planting. If you're not planting, you're cultivating, or you're horning. If you're not horning, you're harvesting it. And even stuff that dried out in the field, you use. You know, that was a job, too, to sit around and share the peas and that so that you'd have something to plant for next year. So we raised our own food. And like I say, I still think we the sharecropper that never got our share, because everything was pretty much hammered down. You know, every year it's going to be better next year. But it never got any better. So my brothers got old enough and wise enough to just decide they didn't want to be farmers. And once the older brothers, you know, they did make an agreement with my mom and dad that they would help them gather the crop that they had planted, but don't count on them to plant another one. And so they all left home at an early age.
Were your parents upset that they didn't continue on in that line of work, or were they glad that they were moving on to other types of work that might have been easier?
Well, my brothers sit down and talk to my mom and just told her that that's not what they wanted to be. And so she sit down and talk to my dad about it, and so they... Once they agreed to it, that they wasn't going to do it anymore, my dad was also a carpenter by trade, and so he built a house. It was walking distance from a couple miles from where we were born, where I was raised at, but it was in the community, and that was the first time that I'd ever had neighbors across the street or next door. So, you know, that was all getting used to, because normally when we walk in the yard, it wasn't anything there but us and our our cows and, you know, and our hogs and our chickens. But it was a whole different lifestyle. It was like almost like moving from the country to the city to actually move in a community where there was other kids that, you know, and actually have playtime.
Right.
But like I said, I was probably the only one that wanted to go back because I didn't know any better. I missed the cultivators and I missed it all the things that we used to play on. And I knew all the trails and stuff through the woods. So I was kind of had to get used to being around people, tell the truth, you know, other than, you know, at school. But to be able to actually get up and walk across the street and talk to a neighbor or something, that was all new to me. But so it was actually a big step up from the life that I grew up in. I started school at the age of 7 because my birthday was like February 13th and you had a certain deadline, so I couldn't start the school at 6. So I started at the age of 7. And I've still got to go very little, you know. But like I say, those 3 months would be the time to register and get on the roster, and then we was like absent the rest of the year until, and, you know, so there was no way you could keep up with the class, and there was no way, you know, nobody that could tutor us or whatever. So I missed out on a lot of, I missed out on the education as far as the books.
Yeah.
But I got a lot of stuff that the people that was going to school didn't get. And that was like mother wit and survival. So I learned how to live off the land. I learned things that, you know, where I can live in conditions to where average city kid would have gave up. But to us, it was daily. You know, my dad hunted at night, work all day, hunt all night. But, you know, he'd come home with whatever he brought home, that's what we ate. So, you know, it's like raccoons were like gourmet steaks, you know. And a possum tasted pretty good. I think about the Beverly Hillbillies. Sometimes I look at, you know, some of the recipes that Granny would cook up. But my mom could take a fish head and make a fish head stew. And, I wish I had saved the recipe, you know, right. Because it was just that good, you know. Kid, you know, being small, you know, we rotated what part of a chicken you would get, you know, but I was satisfied with the neck and the feet. You know, I didn't know no better.
Oh, they gave that to you because you were the youngest brother, huh?
Yeah. And so I ate neck and feet till I got old enough to complain. Then I, you know, and before you know it, I was on the list to get a wing. But it still rotated. It wasn't, you know, we had plenty of chickens. We had hogs. We had cows. But we didn't do a lot of cow killing. You know, most of the cow was for milk. And then when they were too old to milk, they was ready for slaughter to sell bond so that, you know, that so it'd be some cash coming in to pay bills. So it ain't like we had a yard full of cows and we was eating steaks, you know. It wasn't like that. We was eating more like cow tripes. And,
right.
You know, the feet, I remember there was a tea that they used to make off the cow feet, and it was good for fever and all this kind of stuff. All the old remedies, I, you know, sometimes sit down and I just think about, boom. But, you know, I'm not a complaining guy. I'm not throwing a pity party. Mm-hmm. I'm just grateful because I came from deep in the Louisiana woods and all the way into Hollywood, you know. And I always say I made it from the cotton field to Beverly Hills. So
when did music become a part of your life?
Oh, my dad and mom sung in a quartet. And as far as I can remember back, I always would be sitting on the front row watching, you know, and I loved the piano player. As soon as I got in the choir, at the age of, I want to say at the age of 7, 8, and I sit as close as I could to the piano player and watch her fingers. And every now and then, you know, not one church was going on, but every now and then during a rehearsal or something, she would let me hit, let me bang on the piano for a second or two. I just wanted to hit one key, make one or two sounds. Because the same piano player that we had at the church was also the music teacher at school. And so by her letting me play it on the school piano just a little bit, I couldn't play anything, but I just loved it, that sound of that music. So I bought my first guitar at the age of 10. And actually, I was supposed to be buying a pair of shoes, and I had to actually work for the money, you know, and it was going to be my first time to pick out my own shoes, you know, without Dad actually going to pick them out for me. And so I had a $20 bill, and me and my friends walked to the store, which was about 5 or 6 mile walk. But that wasn't nothing for kids playing, you know, walking and talking. But when we got there, just before we got to the shoe store, there was a store with a guitar in the window. It was called White Autos, but it was, you know, an auto store. And there was this beautiful guitar in the window. And it had a price on it for $19.95. And I had a $20 bill. So I talked over my friends, and they said, man, if you buy the guitar, we will help you mow some yards to get the shoes. So my dad came home from work that evening. He wanted to see the shoes I bought. And I had a guitar. And I never will forget the statement he made. You want to spend all that money on this guitar and can't play Mama's Baby. But I was determined to play Mama's Baby. But actually, on the way back, we sung all the way back from town, that whole 5 miles. I never quit picking it. And I had blisters on my fingers, bloodshot blisters. And for some reason, I'd bust them and start over again. I just couldn't leave it alone. But we would be crawfishing. All the guys would go crawfishing and, you know, on a ditch that ran behind our house. And just a little canal ditch. But we'd always be crawfishing there, and I'd take my guitar down there. And I'd play, and the guys would, whatever crawfish we caught, we'd cook them. When we cooked them, I didn't have to crawfish, because as long as I was playing the music, they gave me the crawfish. So it was kind of like I was a celebrity on the crawfish hole at the age of 10.
Never gets better than that.
That was a song out, Why Your Treatment So Bad. And I don't even know who wrote the song, Why Your Treatment So Bad. But that was one of the first songs that I learned to actually play as a cover role, you know, as a cover song. But I guess I wrote my first song when we were playing. See, here's the deal. I wasn't used to school. I wasn't used to going to school but a few months, and I always had a big brother, a big sister on campus. But somebody to look out for me. But once they got out of school, they just, you know, when they come off the farm, they just went on to work different fields. Nobody really got a diploma other than my baby sister and my oldest sister. They were the educated too. My middle sister, I think she quit in 11th grade. Everybody was quitting in 11th, 12th grade. But I remember my dad, I had learned how to be a carpenter from following my dad around. So one day I was playing hooky from school, and the principal, somebody had broken his house and stole the money from the candy machines and the vending machine. And he sent to, everybody knew I knew how to do carpenter work. So he sent to the school. And I don't think I was in the fourth grade then. But he sent for me to come and change the lock on his door.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't on campus. That's when they found out that I was playing hooky. So my dad disciplined me for that. But it was so much going on. I wasn't the only one playing hooky. I had so many friends. We just would walk across the campus and through the trail and meet in the woods, and we'd shoot marbles or, you know, play cards all day for a nickel. You know, back then, you're only getting, I remember when lunch cost a nickel a day. And then it finally went up to 7 cents and then a dime. It got to 15 cents. That was just too much because my dad had too many of us to send to school, at 15 cents a day.
Right.
So we started taking our lunch to school because back then, even in my young adulthood, but I won't say adulthood, I was old enough to go to work. My first job, I made $25 a week, man, it was, you know, you couldn't tell me nothing. And $25 a week, on Friday, I didn't even go home. I was scraped from the field to the club. You know, it was a nightclub, and they didn't care how old you was. If you had 75 cents, you could get a bottle of Ripple. You know, I remember when Ripple was a quarter, and you get a fifth of wine for a quarter. I also remember when Prince Albert Tobacco, my dad showed me how to roll. I used to roll his cigarettes. He would just hand me a can, tell me to roll him a cigarette. And I learned how to do that just watching him. And so anytime him and his friends were sitting around, he'd call me and they'd roll a cigarette. And everybody thought that was fantastic that, you know, 7-8-year-old kid could roll cigarettes so fast.
Were you playing music in those clubs too, Mr. Finley?
They were just playing jukebox. I was the first one that took a guitar in there. And the owner of the club unplugged the jukebox.
All right.
And he had me stand in front of the jukebox. And instead of putting the money in the jukebox, they put it in my hat.
Right.
And back then a record didn't cost but a nickel. You get five records, I think you would get seven for a quarter or something if you put a whole quarter in there. But just the idea, that was showbiz. And I was playing in my daddy's yard, and he told me, y'all not going to sing that blues in my yard. He was working on a house next door and heard us over there. And I was on, had a guitar. The drummer was beating on a tub, beating the bottom out of a foot tub and, whatever they could find to make noise. Sometimes they would grab their mom and dad pots or pans or something out the kitchen, and we'd all meet up and just play. But this day, we decided to play in the yard. But I didn't know my dad was that close to home. And he was putting the top on the house, and he got down off the house and come over there and run us out of his yard, say, if y'all gonna play that devil music, go to the club. He just said it like that, not thinking that we would go, because I'd never been in the club.
Right.
But we walked to the club, and sure enough, the man let us in. It wasn't nobody there hardly anyway, but he let us in, and he said, the first thing he told me, well, your daddy don't want you up here. And I say, he the one told me to come up here. And because my dad used to go and actually, literally whoop my brother and them out the club, just go in there and make them come out, because he didn't believe in the blues. So he would actually go in there and make them get out of the club, embarrass them in front of all their friends. But they went right back. So finally he just gave up at my time, he told me, he says, I'd have been wearing myself out, whooping all these boys, trying to make them be something. But I'm not going to, I done whooped all these years, and they didn't want to do it, so I ain't going to even waste it. You don't want to be nothing, don't be nothing. And so I was like, okay. But I know my dad loved us all because, he went beyond and above to provide. He was a hell of a provider. He could take nothing and just, make the best out of it. But he loved to sing and he loved to pray. That's what he was known for, just singing and praying. He didn't play any instruments, but he didn't need any instruments. I mean, when he sung, they had an old foot stomp that you could hear it for miles before you get to the church. You could hear the people stomping on the old wooden floor. So he didn't need, and I remember being just a little lad sitting on his knee, and once he started singing, somebody would always come and get me off his knee. And he'd get up and he'd walk the aisles of the church, and I don't know, he just, as old folks say, he'd tear the church up every time, and all the preachers would love for him to just be in the congregation because they knew he couldn't sit there too long without he go into his worship away. So
that must be where you get some of your showmanship from then.
Well, I guess so. From sitting on his knee and wanting the attention that he was getting, I would say, yeah. My mom was kind of quiet, but she had a hell of a voice. And when she did cry out, how you say, like E.F. Hutton, everybody listened. But she didn't she didn't get the enjoyment out of it that my dad did. You know, my mom, she was always quiet and real strict on religion, but she would bend the rules a little bit, and you know, and then and sooner or later, I didn't know no better. I'd tell it, you know, and she used to let us listen to a little bit of something on the radio other than gospel, but I remember sitting in my dad's lap while he was driving, and there were posters on every, we were going down the highway, and there was a poster on every telegram pole. B.B. King was coming, you know, was coming somewhere, and that wasn't far from where we were. It was in Mississippi, but, you know, that's just across the line of Louisiana. And I always said I wanted to do, you know, I wanted posters of me. I wanted all this stuff. And I wanted that attention. But I never would have thought that here it is. I just turned 67. And then I'm all known all over, pretty much all over the world just by social media.
This week's episode is brought to you by Nation of Heat Records and my new album, The Diving Sun, to be released on March 19th, 2021. Let's take a listen to the first single, Crescent Bridge. What began as a search for songs for a B-sides album morphed into an obsessive remix and morphed again into a proper album process. This new album features songs from sessions from my album Windfall and from The Flooding Color, and also a handful of songs written and recorded during the COVID quarantine. The result is an album that's unlike any other I've ever produced, but which also stands shoulder to shoulder with any album I've ever released. It drives a dark car, no heart, rebel with a gold car. I'm here waiting on the crescent bridge, and she's a true bride, bright side, parliaments and brown eyes. I'm here waiting on the crescent bridge. That's entitled Crescent Bridge from the forthcoming album, The Diving Sun. Go to joepugmusic.com to hear it in its entirety. It's common to hear about artists who are savants, who were discovered before most people finish college, who became a household name before most people own a home. But some of the most iconic artists don't find their voice and their path until much later in life. It seems like that's the case with Robert Finley. And there's a wonderful profile of another late-blooming artist by Alex Haberstadt in the New York Times that I would love to quote in part here. It's regarding, of all people, Rodney Dangerfield. Imagine having no talent. Imagine being no good at all at something and doing it anyway. Then, after 9 years, failing at it and giving up in disgust and moving to Englewood, New Jersey and selling aluminum siding. And then years later, trying the thing again, though it wrecks your marriage, and failing again. and eventually making a meticulous study of the thing and finding out that by eliminating every extraneous element, you could isolate what makes it work and just do that. And then, after becoming better at it than anyone who had ever done it, realizing that maybe you didn't need the talent, that maybe its absence was a gift. These were the stations of the Via Dolorosa of Jacob Cohen, aka Rodney Dangerfield. At his peak, he was the funniest entertainer ever. That peak was long in coming. By the time he perfected his act, he was nearly 60. The one-liners were impeccable, unimprovable. Dangerfield spent years on them. He once told an interviewer that it took him 3 months to work up 6 minutes of material for a talk show appearance. Lacking inborn ability, he studied the moving parts of a joke with an engineer's rigor. With some of his jokes, the angle between setup and punchline was so acute that it momentarily stunned the audience, requiring an extra beat to sink in and creating opportunities of timing. You can watch one at the close of a Dangerfield set on The Tonight Show. The stand-up portion kills, but everyone knows the better part will happen at the host's desk, where Johnny Carson will gamely set him up. In the chair, Dangerfield continues performing. The laughter is strangled, then builds. As the tendrils of comprehension are still making their way through the audience, Dangerfield turns to the guest next to him and says, "What's new with you?" Pandemonium erupts. Carson staggers out of his chair and laughs that hyena laugh that told you he was really laughing, then looks at Dangerfield and, gasping for breath, asks, "I assume you're through?" Dangerfield flashes a rare look of satisfaction. Can there be any sweeter revenge for all those years of getting no respect than achieving quantifiable perfection? Very famously, you kind of got your break onto the national stage later in life. Can you kind of describe to our listeners how that happened and how you came into the national consciousness in that way and what that was like for you?
To be honest, I was doing my carpenter work until when I got out of the military. Well, actually, I was doing music in the military. And I was doing music before I went in the military. I played for the first group that I played for was the Gospel Bells. Then I started playing, after I went in the service and come back, I started playing for the Harmony Five, because that was a group that my mom sung with. And I played for the Harmony Five, and their children were, you know, they had a large family of kids. And it was hard for the adults to rehearse without the kids coming in and wanting to take part. So I wind up starting a group with the kids. And I call them Brother Finley and the Gospel Sisters. And we found a few sponsors. And they sponsored us a radio show. For Sunday morning was Brother Finley and the Gospel Sisters. So we actually would go down to the radio station and sing live every Sunday morning. And all I had to do was talk about the sponsors that were sponsoring us and tell them who we were sponsored by, which was all local stores, grocery stores, laundromat, and service stations, you know. As I remember, it was a store called Gravit that had a laundromat, and it was, you know, it was a liquor store and grocery store all combined. There was a store called CA Arena, which was basically the same, but they sold Western gear along with their stuff, service station and stuff. And there was a cleaner's. That was on the corner was, I think it was Griffin Cleaners, that you know, where everybody was, it wasn't but one cleaners in town, so everybody cleaned their clothes there, and I did the commercial for that. And then there was Macklemore, Jenny John, which was a major grocery store. So between all of those stores, they would pay in the little for the little radio spot. And so we did Brother Finn and the Gospel Sisters. And it went on for quite a while until the kids started getting grown, and they all started moving about and moving out, you know, leaving the state. So there were... Then the young boys, I call them the Gospel Brothers. And we got them some radio play and stuff. But we stayed busy every Sunday night somewhere we were performing. So it was great, you know, for the kids. Got them exposed and to a lot of, you know, things that they never experienced. But... there were, you know, their parents did not want them singing the blues, you know, and so I had to stay with the gospel as long as I was, you know, managing that group. But life will give you the blues. So, you know, when bills go to coming in your name and, you know, more bills coming in than income. That originates the bills. If you're ever going to have it, you'll get it from bills and problems. So I wound up marrying, at that time, one of the girls that were one of the daughters of, you know, of one of the of the group, the Harmony Five. Her mom and dad sung in the group, and so I guess being that's what the excuse to be around a lot. And me and her got tight, and matter of fact, she got pregnant with my oldest daughter, the one that follows me around now, that takes me places and stuff, you know, the one Christy, she's actually singing background on my next album. But she started singing when she was 2 years old, and she was singing on radio on KMAR every Sunday morning, and everywhere we went, people wanted to see their baby sing. So it's only natural that she can't really help but do what she do, because she's always done it. And then when she was old enough, she was in the choir, and from the choir to quartets. And so she has a set of twin boys that's 16. And I actually bought them their first set of drums when they were 4 years old, and she was like, "Daddy, I work, I come in, I gotta hear all this noise." I'm like, "Baby, just put them a little further from the house, put them on the garage, but don't take the instruments." And now she are so glad that I actually bought them the drums. I bought them the guitars, and I gave them all guitars, and I gave them pianos, and I just wanted to keep the tradition alive. And now I think my grandson may have been 12 years old or 13 some when he became a minister of music at that church, and he's still the minister of music. He's auditioned for Disney World and Walt Disney and all kinds of stuff. And they tell me he passed the audition, but he was trying as an actor. But they know about his musical traits, but the kid can play any instrument that you put in front of him. You know, it just come natural for him. I gave him a guitar, and I went on the road. When I came back, he was playing it. I gave him, I wrote a song and didn't get a chance to arrange it, and I give it to him, and he did it in his own way. And since then, he's been writing and producing his own stuff. And I'm like, I'm just, you know, I tell them all the time that I don't want them to have to go through what I had to go through to get a chance to display my talent. But it's all about being in the right place at the right time. It doesn't matter how good you are. If you don't display your talent, nobody knows what you can do. Right. I mean, nobody knows you can cook an apple pie until you cook one and let somebody taste it, you know. Just sitting there saying, hey, I'm a great cook, and you don't cook, and nobody tastes it, it doesn't mean anything. But if you decide that something you want to do, you can, and you believe you can do it, no matter how much you believe you can do it, it's not going to work until somebody else hear you do it or see you do it. Because fans is what makes stars. You can be born a star and then never be recognized. You can be born with all kind of gifts and never be recognized for them.
So what did it feel like for you to finally be recognized for what you're so talented at?
To be honest, I'm so grateful. But at the same time, the main test is to stay humble. Reason I say that, I always tell my grandkids and kids, if I can get up in the morning and I can put the same hat on my head that I wore yesterday, then my head didn't swell overnight, you know. So you got to be cautious of how you conduct yourself. You got to try to stay normal. And, I mean, I've seen people that are great talent, but messed up attitudes.
Yep.
And self-centered. And they're arrogant, and all of a sudden, they're better than everybody else. They're more than everybody else. So after a while, nobody else wants to deal with them. I know guys that are really great musicians, but they can't keep a band together because of their attitude.
Yep.
They're ungrateful. They become the least bit of thing, tick them off. They talk to everybody like they're on the dog or like they got a tail on them or something. And that will destroy you just as fast as it will get you discovered. I mean, you can get out there and you can do your best and people love you. Then you can start mistreating people and looking down on people. I'm too good. I ain't got time for you. Don't bother me. And that is self-destructive. So it doesn't matter to me. I mean, I realize now I need to be careful and prayed up dealing with the public. But people don't have to appreciate you. People don't have to buy your music. There's no law saying they got to buy your music. You got to have a driver's license to drive, but you don't have to buy the music to dance. So people don't have to love you. So it's a great feeling to be loved and appreciated for what you do. And I still do everything I ever did. I mean, if I go by a friend's house and they killing a hog, I'll jump in the hog pen with them, you know what I'm saying? Because I don't ever want to forget where I come from. I could have did my video anywhere in the world. I did videos in Hollywood. I did videos in Los Angeles. I did videos overseas, like in France and Spain and Italy. I got clips of all that. But when they came to do this new album, to really grasp to what it was about, I decided to take it back to the country. And that's why I named the album Sharecropper's Son, And that's why we went to Biloxi, Mississippi to do it, to video it. I went back in the cotton field and people was like, even my producer was like, man, I don't know how to even ask a black man to go back in a cotton field during these days and time. And I'm like, I really wouldn't have had it no other way. Because anything else would have been a lie or make-believe. And if you lie, sooner or later the truth is going to come out. So if you start off telling the truth, then you don't have no reason to lie. I mean, you know, and like I tell people all the time, I'm not a politician, so there's no excuse for me lying to the public. Just keep it real.
Right.
That's where I come from. That, you know what I'm saying? I thank God that I don't have to go back. I went back volunteering. You know, I went back to display the roots from which I come from. I didn't go back because times was hard and I just had to pick some more cotton. I stood in the middle of the cotton field and I danced. And I didn't pick not one bowl. You know what I'm saying? Because I didn't have to. I'm here this time because I want to be, not because I have to be. And the song, this album, was more or less centered not about I can sing, not about I can dance, not about I can write, but it was to tell my story. And you know, to be able, for at one time, nobody wanted to hear nothing I had to say. You know what I'm saying? And I almost became a minister because that was the only place that you could talk to a whole lot of people and not be interrupted. You know, when the preacher's doing the sermon, they might not like it, but they're not going to get up and say, hold up, Rev, wait a minute. You know, very seldom that happens. So, because there's more people want to hear the truth than it is want to deny the truth. So I'm like, okay. And at one time I did thought I was called for priesthood, but I realized that it wasn't God that called me to preach. It was the people. Because I could sing and I could play the guitar and I knew I was raised up on the Bible, somebody said, you ought to be a preacher. And I said, okay. And so that's one of those things where that was not my calling. If it is, it's more I would say a teacher than a preacher. Now, if I had to preach a sermon, I mean, I could, because I've done that before, but I'm like, why am I sitting in the pulpit with my leg crossed like I got all the answers when I'm probably the most confused person in the church? So I stepped down from it. I didn't lose my faith. I didn't lose my belief, but I knew that I wasn't living the life I was talking about.
What role does your faith play in your creative process, and what role does your faith play in your life as an artist?
I think without the faith, you know, because you got to believe in something. You got to believe in something or somebody. And with my childhood upbringing and then with the experiences I've had. See, in 1976, I was in an automobile accident, me and my brother. I broke 7 bones. You know, punctured my lungs. So, well, I would never gonna be able to walk again, broke off my femur, and I had head concussions. I had a whole bunch of stuff that they said I wouldn't recover from. And I was discharged from the Herman Hospital there in Houston. in a wheelchair. And so I had two wheelchairs. I had one for every day and one for the weekend if I decided to go out, that kind of recline and stuff. But they didn't have the electric wheelchairs and scooters and stuff like that. But my own sister walked in the room and looked at me and turned around and ran out because she didn't recognize me. I had swole 3 times my body size. I don't know. They say some intern hooked up where they supposed to have been pumping air out of my lungs. They hooked it up backwards and it was pumping air in. And I remember my mama had never really been out of Louisiana, but my brother brought her to see me because the doctor said I had 7 to 8 hours, you know, to live because of my condition. And my mind went back to childhood and my upbringing, and I started to pray. And everything started to turn around. And so the next thing, a couple months later, I was moving around in the hospital so much, every time they came to my bed, I was never there. I remember getting on the table that they feed you on. I would get on it, roll out of the bed, and get on it. And I had one good leg, and I'd ride it and drag the other one. And they was constantly having to find me and put me back in the bed. And finally, the doctor said that I was an inspiration to him and all the other patients because I just started answering the phone, and whoever the phone was for, I would take it to their bedside, you know, and just, you know, we had where you could plug the phone in beside anybody's bed. But as soon as they unhooked me from that sling where my legs were hanging, I started getting up. When I found out I could actually sit up on the side of the bed, then I leaned on my table and I just would scoot and roll everywhere I could go, you know. And finally, the doctor just told me he might as well send him home because we can't keep up with him anyway. So when my brother come got me, we took those two wheelchairs and I stayed with his girlfriend. You know, we was all young then. 27, so he was still, you know, in his young prime too. So he would be gone all the time, and what I would do, I would scoot down the stairs. We lived, you know, and had a long staircase, and I could sit down and scoot down the stairs, and I'd get in my wheelchair, and the kids in the neighborhood would push me around. They pushed me to the store, you know, and I just buy them all the pop or some chips or some ice cream, and they just push. So every morning, there was a flock of kids in front of the door, waiting on me to scoot downstairs so they could push me to the store because that was, you know, they was going to get their can and ice cream. So it was, like I say, faith brought me to a lot of things. I mean, just believing. I never not believe. I've always prayed for churches, prayed gospel, but I'm the only one in my family that ever went public with singing the blues. I had a couple times my brother would sit in with me or something if I was doing a local show, but for them singing the blues, that was totally against our upbringing. So I guess I was the black sheep of the family.
Did your father ever reconcile with that fact that you went on to sing what he was literally calling the devil's music? Was he able to reconcile with you on that and that choice that you made?
Well, not really, because he passed in an automobile accident when I had just turned 17. Mm-hmm. And he never accepted it to the fact, you know, to where he would sponsor it or support it. You know, I left home when I was 15. A friend of mine came home that I grew up with, and he came to pick up his brother to take him to New Orleans. And out of the blue, I just asked him, could I go too? And so he said, yeah. He didn't care that. And so I got in the car with him. I didn't take hardly no clothes. I just took a change of clothes. And just so happened when they came to pick me up, my dad drove up. And I told him I was finna go to New Orleans. And he was like, you don't know nobody out there. I said, well, I know these two guys. And he was like, just call me. If you get ready to come home, just call me. And so I went on to New Orleans, and by me was being tall, and I actually was good at imitating people because we always, that was one of our way of having fun. We either mocked the preacher or mocked whatever we heard, you know. And I could change my voice. I guess that's one of the gifts that I use now in my music, is going from false center to anything between false center and bass.
Right.
I put a hat on. I was, like I say, I'm 6 feet tall, 6 feet four. So I put me a hat on and some shade, took a pipe in my mouth, and went and applied for a job. And I got a job working at a steel company. And wasn't long after being there, I was pretty much doing what I wanted to do because I had learned everybody's job. I just, whatever somebody else was doing, I watched them, and I could do whatever they were doing. So the guy just wherever they was as short as yet or behind it, they just put me there. And I was working. I stepped on a nail. And it was weird. They showed me a building. The guy, superintendent, showed me a building, a skyscraper downtown. And they didn't take me to the doctor. He told me to go there. And my mom and dad had always told me, don't lie to the doctor. Mm-hmm. So I had lied about my age up until I got to the doctor, and the doctor asked me how old I was, and I told him I was 15. And that's when I got my pink slip. But, you know, my mom, she could have sued the company for hiring and everything, but she was like, if they were nice enough to give you a job, I'm not going to, you know. She didn't believe. We didn't believe in suing, and we didn't believe in welfare. My dad would not. He had too much pride to stand in the line and get commodity, as they were calling it then. Pretty much the same thing. But he had too much pride to do that. So he was like, what little bit they give, we can be them harvest that out the field. Because we had, you know, we, like I said, we had food. We planted our own corn. We planted our own peas. Matter of fact, we planted peas and corn on the same row, and so the peas could run up the corn stalk. We wouldn't have to bend over to pick the peas, you know. So it was, he had his own way of creative thinking. And so we growed tomatoes. We growed okra. We growed everything. Then my dad, they would kill a hog. So we'd have, pork chops and they do the fat meat. So they cured their own meat. And, you know, if you got hungry and mom hadn't cooked, you could just take a knife and walk out in the smokehouse and cut you a piece of meat, you know. You know, Dad would he'd complain about it, but he never. That was one of the things we could do and not get disciplined about. You know, we get scolded about going out there eating up a whole ham or something.
I'd like to do that right about now.
When he go out there to get something, it's gone. But other than that, I think I had a poor childhood, but it was a good one, and it was safe. Like nowadays, you know, I remember when we had Kolar lamps, you know, it was quite a while before, you know, we had Kolar lamps in the fireplace. And then one day, somebody helped my dad. My dad helped somebody on the carpenter work, and then in return, they had electricity brought to the house because there wasn't no light poles or nothing down there where we were. So, but I think the real reason we got electricity was because the guy had built a big, nice barn, and electricity had to pass by our house to get to the cow barn. And I think that's probably the only reason why we wind up getting it. I don't think they ran it down there just for us. But, yeah, I mean, it was nice when you don't know, you know, because that was the only way of life we knew. And you pick, you know, you pick it. I remember the first cotton I picked, I put in a white sock. And I kept filling that sock up with cotton. Every time Mama and Dad come to come, the kids, our job was to play in the trailer. You know, like they come dump the cotton in the trailer. We was allowed to play in the trailer. But really, we thought we was just having fun, but we were packing the cotton so that the bale would weigh more so they could get more cotton on the trailer. So we walking around in and playing and having us a good time. But actually, we were working, too, because if Dad came back and the cotton wasn't packed, he had a problem with that.
Right.
And so you know, you pack the cotton, you tote water out to the field so that everybody don't have to stop and come get water. And it was just one of those things.
Well, Mr. Finley, you've got a story different than any songwriter we've ever had on this show before, and I think that's why your record sounds so different and so beautiful. And I want to thank you so much for being on the Working Songwriter podcast.
I appreciate you, my man.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Finley.
Thank you.
Peace.
For calling.
Yes, sir. Bye.
Okay.